Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Peter Case. The acclaimed singer-songwriter's new album, My Life to Live, Peter Case at McCabe's, captures him live at the storied Santa Monica music store and venue, McCabe's, as he performs a variety of songs from across his ever-growing discography and finds time to contemplate the nature of storytelling at this moment in history. The album is out April 24th via Sunset Boulevard Records as a CD and double vinyl release, and will also be available on digital streaming platforms. The always thoughtful Case shared some of his favorite memories of McCabe's, as well as how spending time as a street musician in his early life shaped the way he approaches his work on the stage. That's Peter Case on Into Music, coming up now. Happy to be talking to you about this album, which you recorded at McCabe's, and McCabe's is like a... This is a really important place for you, yeah?
Yeah, it was kind of my, I call it my home club, you know. It's a place where I really came out as a solo performer and a acoustic performer. And it was a big turning point for me when I started to play there in 84. I didn't really know exactly what I was doing as a solo artist live back then, but I learned at McCabe's. And so it was like a very important place to me. And I've kept a following there all through the years. We just had two big shows there over the weekend. You know, I had like three shows in the Los Angeles area and two of them were sold out, and, you know, it was great. But I love McCabe's. And I was, so when it was time to make a live album, you know, live at McCabe's seemed like the obvious place to do it.
Now, you, and you even mentioned this on the album, you've seen shows there as well as an audience member, not the Beatles or the Stones, but...
what? All right, there's a joke on there about that.
Yeah. What is it about that place that's like so cool as a like an audience member?
It's very intimate, but it's kind of big, so that you can get like 150 or 200 people in there, but it's intimate still. And I saw they used to have a booking. The people they would book there would be just the legends of folk music, you know, like Townes Van Zandt and Dave Van Ronk and Ramble Jack Elliott, and you know, everybody played there, you know, and so it was a wonderful place to play. You know, Lucinda and me and Victoria Williams all came up through there, and it was just really fun. It was kind of a, not only just a club, but it had a real kind of atmosphere of like a home or like a hangout or a, it was a whole scene, you know. It was kind of a world of its own. And so I met all these performers there too, and you could meet people there. So I met Ramblin' Jack and, oh God, you know, Townes and Guy Clark and, you know, Doc Watson I met there one time. And, you know, I met Memphis Slim there, you know. It was an incredible place. You could hang out and really kind of penetrate. You know, I started playing there before the Americana movement started. You know, I was the first person sort of from a band that I know of that started playing solo shows, solo guitar, solo shows, and it brought, you know, all, you know, because I grew up listening to all that kind of country blues records and country records, you know, and Woody Guthrie especially, and Mississippi John Hurt especially, so as well as Bob Dylan and Eric Anderson and people like that. So Eric Anderson, who played McCabe's, you know, it's an important place for me. It was a real growing, you know, it was a place where I kind of grew up as a musician and artist.
So this is probably also a place that, and I think you're describing this, you go in there and you're going to see other musicians hanging out. Some of them maybe who are on their way up, some who are established. And you're also, as a performer, probably looking out and seeing that and going, oh, cool.
One time I was playing at McCabe's, I looked down and this guy staring up at me right below. It's kind of like, it's like about a 3 or 4 foot stage. And then right down there at the bottom of it, looking up at me, was Mickey Dolenz. And, you know, you just never knew who you would see there, you know. Luca Bloom, you know, came to a show, and New Earth would always come. And, you know, there are people passing through town, you know. would be there. They'd drop in at McCabe's to see me play. So it was always a great place to play. And on stage, I'd see all my old friends and band members, and Steve Earle and me jammed there. And I jammed with so many different people there. Bonnie Raitt played piano with me one time when I was playing there, and Mickey Raphael and T-Bone Burnett. And, it was just fun. I saw Richard Thompson debut the material from a new album before he'd done it. Him and Danny Thompson played there. And it was one of the great, probably the best time I ever saw Richard. I loved that gig. And, kind of a magical place. I mean, it's a great place, when people are. And it's still, and to this day, it still has that vibe, and there's a new group of people and a younger group of people that are working there, and they're bringing the same thing to it. So it's been really fun playing there. I had a great gig over, a couple of great gigs over the weekend. It was just so much fun to play there again, so it stays alive. I was worried during the COVID. People all over the world know McCabe's, and when I talk about it over in Europe, people seem to know about it, and people come to LA as tourists or visitors, they come and visit it. It's out on Pico Boulevard in Santa Monica. And so I was very happy to make a record there. It's a two record set or one CD. And it's got like, when I Len Fico from the Sunset Boulevard Records, he goes, "I want to make a live album with you." And I wasn't really intending to do a live album, but I said, "Yeah, okay." And he goes, "And I want talk. I want the talk too that you get," because he'd seen a bunch of my shows. And he goes, "I want the what you're saying between songs to be on there too." So we caught the whole thing. It's a whole kind of a document of that.
Well, that was what I was kind of wondering, was like how much it represented, like of that time when you were recording it, like that set, or from that period of time, how much it really replicated the live experience. So it sounds like it's exactly that.
Yeah, pretty much. We did two nights there, and we took the best off the two nights. But it's basically, they're definite representation of where I was at during that night, those nights, And so, like, the set list changes from show to show. I'm going on the road again next week, and I just got back from Europe, and I'm playing it. It changes, but essentially, that's like that. That this show really is representative of where I'm at these days. Yeah.
So I've never seen you live, but I really loved listening to the album, getting this sense of the way that you structure a set, because there's a build, and then there's this
Right.
moment where it kind of comes to this emotional realization and so forth. That's not,
Right.
I assume, an accident. I'm assuming that there's a lot of thought about that.
Yeah, well, I always kind of view it like a play or like a movie or something, or like a, it's an opening experience. Like, besides just being entertaining, I'm trying to say a few things and keep it very entertaining and fun and moving musically too. And so, like, it's a whole thing that moves forward through different movements and then ends up somewhere. Yes. And that's the whole idea, to take people on a trip. And I want people to get that thing, the kick I get from, like, when I go see a concert, that I think is really great, is that kind of leaves you inspired to go out and do, or when you see a play sometimes or something, go out and face the world in a kind of a fresh way. And that's what I'm trying to bring to it, without being too, big-headed about it. But just, I'm trying to bring that sense, of some rejuvenation that you maybe get from a thing like that.
Listening to the album, I was thinking about how it kind of put me in the room. And it's like, sometimes I go to shows and I really love the act, but I'm sitting through the show after like eight songs and I'm going, is there popcorn or some other condiment out there? Like, I love these songs, but I could be sitting at home listening to the record. There's no sense that that the audience is there with them. And I felt, again, listening to this, I was like, oh, I feel like I'm in the room.
Yeah, I come from the kind of performers that always, like, really, right there with the audience. Part of that's punk rock, a part of it's folk rock, and folk, but the audience is an important part of the show, It's not so much a thing where you just get up and kind of blast away at the audience, like, playing the latest album or something like that. It's like, it's like you can, it's like a two-way street. You can hear the conversation, the call and response, I guess is what you would call it, between me and the audience. There's people yelling out stuff and we're talking, and it's alive. And so it's a relationship that's alive. It's not just a written in stone or anything like that. And so there's a danger to that. It's like the whole show can go off the deep end. In fact, I think there's a few places in that show where it kind of gets really close to that. But And so a lot of that material was improvised on stage, you know. So the things I'm saying, there were one of the things I didn't want to have happen was to tell stories I'd told before. I'm sort of sensitive about that. So I wanted to like short circuit people yelling out the. I definitely didn't want it on my album that people would yell out the. Who'd heard it too many times or something would yell out, you know, something predictable. So I did a whole thing about stories on there too, you know, which I do believe in, that we're kind of poisoned by stories a little bit. So there's a discussion of that on there too, which I hope is entertaining. But and then finally at the end of the record, there is a whole story, you know, to like, you know, you want to hear one of the stories? Well, here's one. And I laid like the one of the ones out there, but that's another subject really. But yeah, so you're really trying to keep it alive and let, you know, that's what I do, whether I'm making a record or not, you know, trying to do that.
How much of that do you think was kind of learned by playing on the street, just like how to keep people engaged and so forth?
A lot, you know. I think that playing on the street affects the musicians that have done it, you know, like for life in a way. People are going by quickly, so you got to get their attention quickly. But the other thing is that you learn to become comfortable with people listening because you're very, you know, I just got really comfortable just starting to play on the street, like pulling out an instrument and singing on a street corner. There's a huge resistance to that in the air, you know, you're not really supposed to be, it doesn't, you know, it's not exactly encouraged. And so you're sort of breaking like a breaking the rules a little bit, like to start playing on the street. And so you have to become comfortable with just being stepping out in front of people and doing something really different in a place where it doesn't necessarily have a place made for it. So I learned a lot from that. And then, yeah, to engage people quickly. One time I played on the street and Allen Ginsberg came out from across the street at City Lights Books in San Francisco, and he came across. Hey, I'm Alan. You know, you guys mind if I sit in? And we're like, yeah, sure. You know, he goes, can you play country blues? Yeah, we, as a matter of fact, can play. So we started playing country blues, and he started singing to people on the street, and like nobody recognized him, you know. And he was just making up songs as people walked by, you know. And it was really interesting. We did that for a while, and you know, it's a great forum for that kind of thing. I think he came out there to just see what he thought it would be like, you know, and I learned a lot from being a street musician.
Well, imagine too, there's that thing that if you're playing on the street, there's probably times where you might be reacting to, I don't know, maybe there's been a car crash at an intersection or it's threatening rain and you're reacting to that some way by playing a song that fits the scenario or something.
Yeah, certainly. You know, there'd be like a fire, and we'd play Fire Engine by the 13th Floor Elevators. But I used to play Memphis, Tennessee, and sing in this phone booth on the corner of Broadway and Columbus. Like, so I do the whole message. It's a whole song about the telephone, but you know, somebody calling a family member on the telephone. But like, I would actually sing it in the phone booth, you know, just for kicks. Yeah, we did a lot of things like that. And then sometimes you're getting threatened by people or attempted robberies too. Is another. A lot of interesting stuff you had to deal with as a street singer. It could get rough out there, and I've been, you know, punched and, you know, all sorts of stuff happening while you're trying to play. And, you know, you learn a lot about different things from playing on the street.
So when you move that inside a venue and you've got that skill, but now you're in a room, and maybe sometimes I would imagine over the years you play rooms where people really aren't there to hear music. And things like that, does that street instinct kick in?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, I always had that ability to sort of yak it up with people and try to break the ice, you know, that I really did learn it on the street. Hopefully, you're not playing too many rooms like that anymore. You know, you go to places and people come to hear you. So I don't have to go through that much anymore. But there was a time, right, when I first went solo where, you know, you would go places and there. I remember going down to Miami at one point in 1986, and like they hardly even looked at a guy with an acoustic guitar like it was a form of entertainment, you know. Like they didn't really, you know, I was opening a big show for Stevie Winwood, and it was the place didn't even quiet down one decibel like when I played, you know. But you go through stuff like that, you know. I played a lot of big shows with like popular artists like Jackson Browne and Stevie Winwood, and a lot of the shows would go good, but sometimes you'd come out and you'd have to like, you know, reach out to the audience. You know, one of the things I was taught was like, you know, you reach out to the fans of yours that are there at a big show. But I it took a it, it It took a while to get comfortable as a solo performer after being in a band, because like when you're in a, I was doing it when I was a teenager playing solo at different folk clubs and stuff. But then once I was in the bands for 10 years, and so the nerves first, and then the ner and the plimsolls, and the band life has a momentum of its own that you don't even need. Like if you're having a bad night, the other guys in the band might be having a good night, so you can just roll back with them. But when you're having a bad night as a solo band, you're like out there, on your own. And so, I had to learn the art of doing this. It took a while. I didn't just like, it wasn't just stepping out of the plimsolls and then all of a sudden I can play solo everywhere. It took a few years to really get it together. Unfortunately, like those were the years where I sort of had a major label deal, but then, by the time I really started to figure it out, I feel like it was like I was on Vanguard at that point. When I really started, I mean, I knew the songwriting aspect of it, but the performing aspect took longer to get.
You mentioned, for instance, Europe before. Do you have, for instance, like songs that the European, you just know you're going to Europe and it's like they're crazy about this song, and I don't know, maybe your audience in Connecticut is, they would never request it, but like Ireland is like really big about, a handful of songs or something.
Yeah, it's different. I mean, it's more like some of the songs that were like I'm associated with in the States, like A Million Miles Away and maybe Oldest Story in the World and some of the Plimsoll stuff and Nerves. Not too much the Nerves, they seem well more well known, but like the Plimsoll stuff in America they know it, but they don't know it at all over in Europe. And so I mean maybe in Spain they know it. But outside, because we toured Spain, but like outside of that really it's not known. They love songs in Ireland, and like the people follow the story songs and sing along even with songs like that they've just learned that night. And like they really are a song audience. And there's, places in the UK are like that as well. They've got the background of hearing that kind of music a lot. Texas is like that too. And so, yeah, there's different things in different places, but I tend to bring pretty much the same thing. I'm trying to think, did I play a million? I did not play A Million Miles Away that much over on the European tour, but like this weekend I played it down in LA. I played it at every show, So, because for one thing, it's my most popular song, but I don't necessarily feel like it's my best song. But people love it, so I play it, For a long time, I wouldn't even touch it. But I've done a new arrangement for it on this new record, which I really like, which is on the, Henry Cash from Starcrawler. Is playing bass on this record with his brother Bill Stock on pedal steel, and the singer Sophia Sky from Cash and Sky, which is their like kind of their Americana band out of Starcrawler. And so Starcrawler is a great young rock and roll band, and they kind of pushed me to play Nerves and Plimsoll stuff, and so people seem to really like it. And so Henry said from Starcrawler, he says, play A Million Miles Away and Oldest Story, play him on the piano. And it'll be a completely different arrangement. And he was right. And then we put the pedal steel on it. And it gives it this whole kind of trip, takes it to a trippy place that's not the usual place it goes to, but that really works. And so that was great. There are new versions of those two songs.
Yeah, that was one of the moments where I was like, oh, this is a different color to these songs and a different color to the
Yeah.
album. I'm curious, we were talking earlier about McCabe's, which is a place that you played a lot, but now kind of in the post-pandemic world, I would think I've heard from other people, sometimes there's venues that didn't make it and stuff like that, that were real storied places. Have you experienced that? Like when you go back to a city, it's like, oh, that's that place I played, 40 times, and now it's not there. It's kind of weird.
Well, the Cactus Cafe was a place I played for years. It was my home in Austin, and as a club, it was one of my favorite places to play. But it kind of went by the wayside. I don't think it was because of COVID, though. San Francisco had a bunch of great places to play, and now I don't know where I play in San Francisco. It's my home, and I used to play at different places here. But it's the landscape has changed. A lot of clubs have gone out of business. New ones are coming in. I have a place I play over in Berkeley, but it's changed here. Passim, I go to Boston, and it's like the club Passim has been there since 1964. It was called Club 47, and Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and Eric Anderson and Howlin' Wolf. Everybody played there, and it's still there. It's called Passim now, but it's the same club. So there's that kind of thing going on. clubs come and they go. Sometimes they stay, you know, and there's ones that are open for years that like have managed to survive, and you know, it's a great thing. But different places close. Yeah, you're right. You know, the Iota in Washington, D.C. closed, and that was one of my favorite places to play. Now I don't know where I play in Washington, D.C., you know, so it's like you have to figure it out. I play in Baltimore, so I don't know.
You're such a good lyricist. You must be like a big reader.
Yeah, I read books for sure. I don't think you can write lyrics if you don't read books. My opinion. Not just my opinion, but I've had that conversation with a number of people. You got to read, man. Reading's an important part of life. You know, reading is a great, it was a great invention, you know. And so if you're not reading, you're missing out on being able, in an incredible way, to siphon other people's experience into your mind. And so it's a great, great technology, reading.
You've been listening to a conversation with Peter Case. His new album, My Life to Live, Peter Case at McCabe's, is out April 24th via Sunset Boulevard Records. You can learn more about how to order the LP at sunsetboulevardrecords.com. That's sunsetblvdrecords.com. You can find out more about Case himself via his official website, petercase.com. And you can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening, and as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson.